the motion of a small body in a strong gravitational field when you want to go beyond the test mass description where the motion is geodesic, but you're going to the next stage and account for the self-gravity of that body. And a group of us were very taken with that problem, and we have continued to be taken with that problem, and we invested quite a bit of an effort to, first of all, understand what those original papers were trying to teach us, expanding on this, but also coming up with practical methods to actually calculate that motion and do useful things with it. And I think we've done some progress. I think we've made some useful things. But I think it's fair to say that this little group of us that's been involved in this program has been fairly insular. And basically, we rarely come out of our basement to talk to the world about what we've done, because we feel pretty self-sufficient and we like each other, and we're just happy to keep on working like this. But I think once in a while it's good to get out of your basement and face the scrutiny of your peers and ask the question, you know, are we doing something that's worthwhile? Are we on the right track? Should we be doing other things? Are there things that we could be doing based on what we know and our expertise that could be more useful, directly useful to what serious people are attempting to do? I was thinking that a good way of, you know, having this discussion would be through a panel discussion like this, where we've invited some people who came to some of our talks during the CAPA meeting and basically are here to give us the verdict of their opinion and on what we've been doing. So I think what I'll do is to just start with maybe just ask each of you to give, you know, maybe a preliminary statement and maybe some indication of what you would like to talk about. And first of all, I'll introduce the panelists, but I think you all know them. So we have Patrick Brady at the other end of the table, Scott Hughes, and Emmanuel Berti, who are all external people who haven't been involved directly in the efforts of the CellForce program. But I think when I invited them to come to this discussion, I described them as wise men who are also sympathetic observers on what we've been doing. So I'm willing to face scrutiny and the judgment of my peers, but I prefer when it's, you know, friendly people who do it. So anyway, so Patrick, do you want to get started?
Yeah, well, you said everything I wanted to. We sort of have been chatting to try and figure out what we talk about today. And the thing I want to start with actually is a reminder about when CAPRA first started, which was 98. And it's a good time to remember, first of all, we were all still young and arrogant at the time. We really thought we could solve the problem within a year or so. Kip, at the time, also used to remind us that, you know, it was 98, so LIGO would be taking data in 2 years, and LISA would fly by 2008. So this was urgent, okay? But seriously, I think even at the time, there was...
Actually, you don't need to say seriously.
I know. It was very true. At the time, there were, I think, even in the group of people that were there, there were two sort of reasons that people were interested in the problem. One was intellectual, just pure intellectual interest in various aspects, like what would happen to the ISCO, and perhaps also then things about how you would compute and regulate the force itself. So how would you actually go about that part? There was the second piece, which was the motivated by the instruments, and that is calculating the orbits as they would evolve and be seen through the gravitational waves by instruments like LIGO and LISA. It's interesting to me, actually, I was also trying to remember what we actually did during that first meeting, and I went back, actually, because I have the flip chart that was the... so I actually, you know, took a look at what we'd done. Back then, we were reading Burke Thorne, DeWitt Bream, Quinwald, Mino et al., Ori. That was it, you know, about five, maybe six papers. And at this stage, it's actually very interesting to see that the field's expanded to, you know, more than that per year at this point, and quite a lot of progress in it. So I think that sort of sets some of the scene for this. As far as where the conversation go afterwards, I'm going to just leave with the one thing I'm still interested in and found most interesting in discussions, and that was the evolution of the orbits. It seemed like the one contentious thing that I constantly heard during the day and a half of the CAPR meeting I was at. So that's sort of one of the things I'll touch on. So.
Very good.
So I'll say by way of some comment, I think you don't give yourself enough credit, Eric. I mean, you described yourselves as existing in a basement and wanting to come up and sort of see the light and look around. But, you know, as someone, I was at the first one or two CAPR meetings and then kind of went and did other things. I'm sort of coming back in to pay attention. There was this fantastic line from Steve Detweiler, actually, a couple days ago, when he pointed to the talk by Nori Sago, where he had this beautiful result on the influence on periapsis perception due to the cell force. Where, you know, he said, that is one of the best plots we have seen at any CAPR meeting, bar none. I'm probably missing the quote slightly, but Steve, I think that's roughly what you said. What struck me, I mean, I'm in complete agreement with him. I thought that was just glorious to see that come out, that although so many people coming into this community are motivated by very different things, the results that are of interest beyond the, as you call it, the insular Kappler community, they're clearly coming out, and people are doing a great job advertising it and looking around for ways to connect it. And so I'm having not been to one of these meetings in 5 or 6 years, coming back in, I've been having a blast to seeing that all the issues that we kind of, and it was a typical KIPP thing, right? I mean, we were completely off on the time scale 12 years ago, but seeing that the progress is actually happening and it's very healthy has been a lot of fun.
Okay, I take that to be a thumbs up. Emmanuel?
Yeah, I agree with Scott that there's been some remarkable progress, and I have never been to any of the CAPR meetings, so I'm the newbie here. But I think what was most exciting to me is that people are actually starting to compute observables. And I think it's right about time that we start thinking about joining different communities and building, for example, hybrids for data analysis, or think about comparisons with numerical relativity simulations, since we have them finally. And it's right about time that we start thinking about how to use the results of the calculations, because interesting physical results are coming out, and it's right about time to use them. So I would like to focus the discussion on how to come together between the different communities and make the best out of what you've been doing over the past 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so why don't we stay with you, and maybe you can walk us through your slide.
It's not my slide, it's our slide.
Sure,
that's
fine.
Yeah.
I think you'll have to stand up, though, because it's urgent.
Yeah, we can't really see much. So the first is the conceptual issues. This is really Patrick's worry. You have been...
Well, maybe no, I'll just pick that one up. I already sort of mentioned it.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I found somewhat... I actually think it's great. It's clear that the progress on the regulation of the cell force is under control. People understand it. They know how to do it in very complex cases. The thing that I did feel was that the evolution problem, it was confusing as an external observer to know whether or not there were conceptual problems in the way, or just calculational problems in the way. And I mean, I guess to some extent, I talked to a number of people. People could probably raise their hands who got asked by me about this. But I think I came away now with a clear picture. But I wonder if the audience and you, Eric, think whether or not there's consensus that it's purely calculational, and there are no conceptual issues in the way in terms of the orbits. For which orbits? The generic orbits incur.
I think maybe I'll take a brief stab at answering this, but I think, yeah, it's really time to involve the audience. So I think in terms of setting the foundation and really understanding the nature of the problem, I think a lot of progress has been done, and some of that very recently, and I'll quote the work by Sam and Bob on this. So I think we have a very good understanding on how to formulate the self-force problem in a way that involves integrating the perturbation equation simultaneously with the motion And getting, you know, basically setting this up as an initial value problem and determining the orbit and the field simultaneously. In order to do practical things and in order to formulate this problem in Kerr, I think there's still an issue of calculating the metric. You know, how do you do black hole perturbation around a Kerr black hole? We understand how to do this via the Tucholsky route and the metric reconstruction scheme. I think there are issues of getting the non-radiative modes that way because it's not part of the prescription. Whether you regard this as a conceptual problem versus a practical problem, I'm not quite sure. But I think in terms of just formulating the self-force problem, I think we have now the understanding that we need in order to proceed and get the, you know, get the problem solved. But that's my opinion. Who would like to weigh in on that? Sam, do you want to?
Well, I'm not going to object to you citing me for solving problems. but so I would certainly agree, though, I mean, in response to other people's work as well, I think this has really been clarified. In terms of the first order self-force problem, I think we have good-looking equations, you know, no real existence proofs, but no reason to believe there's any problem. You know, good-looking equations that we can solve. And as for going to the next order, I think we have very little idea what to do, but we may not need that for Lisa.
Do we have anyone who would like to express a different opinion?
Wait, let me put maybe Sam on the spot and everyone else. So how would you know if you, that statement you say, maybe we don't need that for Lisa, how would you know? Sorry.
Far be it from me to indirectly disagree with people like Sam and Bob, but I'm going to disagree. I think if you actually look at if you want to do matched filtering on the strongest Lisa sources, right, you've already detected the source, and now you want to try and do, you know, pin down, is this really Kerr? Or some, you know, or other precision tests of general relativity or the astrophysics. I think we do need second order for the very best Lisa sources. We could be wanting error bars that are 10^9 below the first order self force, and since second order effects are probably 10^5 below the first order, I think we definitely want both first and second order. I hope we can get away without third order. That note, I'm saying we want second order. I'm not asserting that I have any, that I have the slightest clue how to do second order. That's your job, Sam.
Anyone else who'd like to comment on this? John, did you have something to say?
So I would. I'd be interested to know if Stan agrees with that assessment.
I think the issue of deciding how much of a self-force do you need to do certain things depend on what you intend to use it for. And I think it's fair to say we don't have a complete understanding of what the end goal is. Yes. And to get there, how much of a self-force do we need? Is it okay to use a first order self-force, is it okay to, you know, do we really need to go to second order? I think one thing that emerged at this conference that was very interesting is the realization that resonances might actually prevent searchers that are fully coherent over the entire spiral. You may well have to stop before a resonance, restart after a resonance, and in such situations, maybe, well, you know, having given up the full coherence over the complete in-spiral could be that, well, in fact, we don't need so much of a self-force than that we thought. So. Yeah,
so it did seem clear from Tanya's description that if you want to go through resonance and not just end and start again, that you would need at least some of the second order calculation to get through the resonance.
So I see Bernard Whiting having his hand up. I just want to make a comment while the mic gets to Bernard that I think, I mean, a lot of this ties into, we have even an item up here, that I think some of these questions are going to be very science goal dependent. You know, there's several different, you know, some people are doing this for the intellectual love of it. Some of us are doing it because we want to do LISA searches. Some of us want to map Kerr space times. And these different end goals are going to play a big role in deciding how deep you need to go in some of these models. I think tying into this question of whether we can do evolutions right now, I think something that would be really interesting to see is whether we can sort of do a, to use Carlos Clares' term, some kind of a chimera of various pieces that are existing now to do something like a Mach-Lisa data challenge with a, you know, a wrong but right enough waveform to begin to ascertain how accurate does the model have to be to do one of these science goals, for example.
Yeah, one other. Okay, I have one other question on this on the same thing here. If you look at circular orbit, then conservative part of self force and it comes in the same order as dissipated, second order dissipated. So the question is, can we calculate second order dissipated simply by knowing the first order trajectory without having to compute the rest of the first order metric?
Yeah, and I don't think we've come up to an answer to that as of yet, right? Bernard?
Yeah, I want to come back to the question or the issue you raised about Kerr and the practical methods of working in Kerr. So both Leo and now John have schemes for working in Kerr. But to some extent, the L equals 0 and 1 modes still not, certainly in John's scheme, is still not completely dealt with. And I wonder if John would comment on whether there are, the problems are purely computational or whether there are still conceptual or technical issues that he feels we'll have to deal with before we have a complete self-force approach in curve at first order formalism.
So I think I'll let John answer this, but after that I think I would like to take the discussion back to the panel who should be leading the discussion.
So this is well for us.
All right, so I'll give a quick answer. I mean, it's a technical question and I'm obviously biased. So what I think is that that for circular orbits in Kerr, it's simply a question of getting change in mass and spin, which you can get from just the conserved stress tensor, and then a change in the center of mass to eliminate dipole moment at infinity. I think that's straightforward. But if you're looking at generic orbits and having to figure out the change in the direction of angular momentum, you've got essentially two more gauge transformations outside the position of the particle, and that. So there, I think there is a conceptual question that that I don't yet know how to deal with, in, at least in a straight, in a simple way, without doing it. You could think of doing a substantial calculation that looks at something like the change in the Ladnau pseudo tensor. I don't know a simple way to handle this, this is something that Leo understands. Doesn't have to be, can be handled in a gauge distinct from the way you're handling the radiative parts of the field. It may be something Leo has thought through. I don't know.
Right, so I think Patrick's got your answer. You've got your answer. So it's yes and no.
Good, that's very clear.
Did you have a second point?
I do think it's already been brought up. I think it's later in our list here, is the question of when you connect between the intellectually curious exploration of self-force to the observational, the goal, what are the scientific questions you're going to attempt to ask when you get data? And so motivating the next steps in what you calculate by trying to identify a couple, one goal. I think Scott already mentioned this in his idea of the Chimera approach to try and set some data challenges. And I was asking Scott, well, Scott, why don't you pick up on what you think are the are two interesting things, right?
That's right, yeah. So I mentioned these briefly. And I think two of the, if I think in terms of, I come at this from the perspective of when to do gravitational wave astronomy, and the two sort of drivers there, at least with the extreme mass ratio measurements, sort of my astronomer hat says I want to have a census of the masses and spins of black holes that are in quiescent galaxies that are going to be the ones that do this. And I sort of mentioned in my talk today that we basically don't know anything about black hole spins. For the ones where we can measure the masses, they tend to be active galaxies that are undergoing quasar outflows or other AGN activity, and so there's a real bias in that thing. And this opens up a whole new window for astronomers to probe the mass function of black holes well beyond the regime right now, where it's basically just the nearby universe where Hubble can resolve the interdynamics of galaxies. And so from the astronomy perspective, when are the waveforms going to be good enough that we are confident we've pinned things down well enough to measure masses and spins very accurately? And I think that's going to be stringent, but it's probably a little less stringent than the thing I concluded the talk with today of trying to actually test the hypothesis that you have a Kerr black hole there. And one of the things which I, coming out of this, I would like to see some guidance and wisdom on is people like Steve Drasko and I have made what I sort of think of as sophisticated kludges, just doing radiative approximation for waveforms where we get the orbital dynamics right and we have sort of a very average way of having it evolve through a sequence of orbits. And you can imagine that that's something you can put into an MLDC right now and we can start building up algorithms for trying to measure those waves. There's a lot of important physics we're missing from that. And I want to know, how hard is it going to be to take some of the results that are starting to come out, which things like Norisago's result, which is so, Nori and Lior's result, which Nori presented, which are such a landmark in this thing, and are beginning to kiss on what we need to do to include the impact that is going to affect the phasing of these things and allow us to sort of answer, okay, is this going to be enough that we can do these kinds of detections? And I think that's why I say this kind of ties into this question of evolution. What are we going to be able to do now? What can we do? It looks to me like we basically have a pretty good understanding of gravitational interactions for Schwarzschild now. There's some gauge issues, as we discussed kind of to death over the past couple of days. But if you're sort of willing to just sort of hold your nose and see how badly does it muck up our models, I think there's something you can work with. How wrong would it be to take some of that understanding and just begin applying it to Kerr models as well and see what happens with that thing? These are the kind of games I would like to see people think about playing, I guess.
And don't forget, it's urgent. Lisa will apply in 2020.
Do you expect an answer?
I want to know whether there's any commentary on, this whole issue of what is in a form now that we can begin to, we want to make connections to the data analysis community. I think this is the way to do it, is we've got a framework now where we can, they're not going to be right, but they're going to be right-er waveforms. And, what can we bring in so we can start making more models that have more and more of the physics right, so we can start testing into things so that Alberto and his friends can tell us whether or not they're going to be measurable.
So I'll ask Lior to provide an answer or to provide a comment.
What am I supposed to comment about exactly? Okay, so I think if you look at Schwarzschild now, I think we can do Schwarzschild from beginning to end, a cleaning order. Right?
Yeah.
I think if you have a model with include dissipation using fluxes and we know everything we have to know it. Everything we can know about the conservative effect of cleaning order, we already have that. So put that into your kludge, and I think you've got a pretty accurate model in Schwarzschild.
Yeah.
So that's something that we can do today. shouldn't be difficult to incorporate these possession results into existing filters.
Sure, that's exactly the kind of thing I was thinking. And I think it would just, even at zeroth order, it would be sort of an interesting exercise to see if you put that in there and you have sort of a self-force enhanced radiative waveform. You know, it's still using flux balancing and all this kind of stuff. But then you compare it to one that doesn't have that. You know, how badly does that mess things up for us? You know, to what extent are that will give us an indication of what we're going to need to do when we do the more realistic generic Kerr models.
So you can actually, you can evolve, you can calculate the evolving orbit, but my guess is that you'll get something very, very close to what you'll get with your model, plus the conservative effects that we can calculate today. That's the guess. It would be good to do it once, to have
yes.
a sort of benchmark.
Exactly.
But I think in more generally, that's exactly how the entire thing should proceed. I mean, I don't see, self-force templates being actually used for LISA. I think it will be used. I mean, what you are going to use eventually, Drasko type kludges, but you need something to compare with. You need benchmarks, and us and Kappa will be giving you those benchmarks against which you could compare. So ISCO shift is also that you can compare with.
So, for example, can you use the scalar self-force calculations in Kerr in this context to do
no.
Not
so
at all.
Yeah, so we are calculating self-force in Kerr, but for scale-free models. So I would consider technology development exercise. But I don't think you can infer anything really to scale any application. You do need to do gravity in Kerr, and we don't have that yet. I don't think there's anything fundamental. That between us and being able to do that in Kerr.
Yeah, so if I could correct part of my stupidity from a minute ago, in putting in the remaining parts of the perturbation, what you could think of as the L equals zero and one charts in Schwarzschild, you just have. You're just talking about the mass, three real parameters that correspond to the change in the spin and the change in direction of the spin, and one real parameter corresponding to a gauge transformation to get rid of the dipole moment. And you fix five real numbers by matching across R equals R zero with the linearized field equations. So there is no.
So anyway, so to go back to Leo's point, I think we're really at the cusp of something interesting because with calculations that can be done now or soon, you can provide useful information that might go into calibrating kludges. And I think I agree with Lior that this probably is going to be ultimately how we're going to be operating. We're not going to provide templates because they're just too costly, but we can certainly, cross-check and calibrate templates that you would construct based on efficiency considerations, or enhance them by adding all the right physical effects. And for Schwarzschild, for gravity, I think you're right that this is something that is well within reach. Steve?
I pretty much wanted to say the same thing, but you beat me to it. But I'll just emphasize that at this point, we have seen no waveform from self-force analysis. And I'm not sure we ever will. What we will see is more or less geodesic motion for a number of orbits. But we'll never do 1,000 orbits. And I'm not sure there's any point to it. And I really think it's the understanding the physics better is what's going to lead us to creating better waveforms, I'd rather not use the word kludge because the more real information you're using, the less kludge it is, and then they'll start to get more accurate. But ultimately, it's going to be looking at solving individual problems, and I'm going to say sort of the way ELB has been progressing. As more information comes in, the better off the people who are thinking about how to turn this information into into templates of some sort or another, the more information they have coming from what Alf Salt described as solutions to real problems, real physics problems. I think that's what's going to be clarify things and it's going to bring us forwards more rapidly than actually creating waveforms. I'll be eager to see a waveform, but I'm not holding my breath.
Mm-hmm. Manuel, is there something you'd like to talk about?
One thing that could be useful in the interaction with the numerical relativity community. So from many of the people in the self-force community, it looks like it's mostly a computational problem at this point. There is not too much of a conceptual issue. So can you get help from numerical relativity people, for example, to speed up calculations of the self-force? I think Nori or Lior were mentioning that a calculation of each of the points in the ISCO shift takes 4 days. So can you get help from the numerical relativity community? I know that Peter, for example, started collaborating with you to help you with time domain calculations. Is there any kind of help you could get?
Yeah.
Is there something more? I mean, since you have people here who
give us computers.
That's not constructive.
I am pushing my own agenda for what I think is a good way to proceed using the 3+1 code to do some of these things, but with 3+1 code, again, we'll never do. We may do a few orbits. We can learn some interesting things, but I don't think we're ever going to see what I'm going to describe as a real waveform. And when I say waveform, you've got to have 10 orbits or something before it really counts as a waveform. And I think that's going to be pushing things. I hope I'm wrong.
If you compute the self-force at the particle, why you simply can't get, you've got dissipative part of self-force, you've got conservative part of self-force, you've got ordinary set of coupled ordinary differential equations. But in a frequency domain and
the extreme mass ratio says that what you're calculating is something which is some level infinitesimal.
And if you're not including second order, and that means what you're really doing is just looking at a geodesic. And you could calculate the self force to see how it would have changed it, but that change, you have to have very good accuracy. And so in a 3+1 code, I don't think we're going to have the kind of accuracy that's needed to trace a very small, to really capture a very small self-force effect.
Well, I don't see something
that limits you in that way,
frequency domains, I think is a good way to go, because there you're doing something that's I'm just going to say it's, you can identify a physics problem more easily in the frequency domain if you've got the appropriate problem.
You're talking about calculating a waveform. I would think you could calculate a waveform for much longer than 10 orbits.
I think we need to pause for a commercial break. So, Jonathan?
Yeah, I want to try and pin Stephen down on something he said a moment ago. Stephen said that he implied it would be interesting to calculate a Emery-Caprot waveform for 10 orbits. Since the radiation reaction that we're trying to, that deviates from a geodesic isn't 1 radian until square root of the mass ratio, which is 300 orbits, isn't the 10 orbit calculation at the end of this day just going to look exactly like a geodesic? Why do you think 10 orbits is interesting?
Because it's more than one.
Okay.
And it's hard. And
okay.
And you can't do a 300 until you can do 10. And so I would say 10 is a good benchmark, and I can imagine doing that. But I can't. I mean, I can. That's a something to shoot for.
Okay.
What? I'm sorry.
If you can do 10, you can do 1,000 orbits. I mean, you know yourself, of course, that all the. You don't have to do this full 3+1 self-consistent, whatever words you're like.
We'll cut this off, but.
Please.
Never mind.
Okay, so I think I would like to steer this back to the panel. So who would like to make the next point? Back to you, Patrick, maybe?
Yeah, I was actually, so this is just it's more about a question, and it goes back to the question of what science we're going to try and extract from the waveforms when we observe them.
And clearly you see that there's a lot of agreement in the audience.
I really can't, so I'm looking at you, not the audience. so if we think about one of the primary goals, the easier one, as Scott mentions, being the mass and spin of the central object, let me ask a question that really probably Scott, you're the one who may have only thought about it, or Steve. What's the loss in accuracy there if we don't have the actual radiation reaction evolution through the whole sequence? So we can only do sequences of geodesics and just do incoherent summing, say, over 100 subsets of the 10 to the 4 orbits or something. I mean, I would have guessed, actually, that you probably are well within the systematics that are interesting to astrophysicists by then.
So someone who's been doing things, the EMRI searches in the MLDC, I'd be curious to hear if there's any input on this. I mean, I would think this is, you could do something kind of semi-coherent by sort of, you know, locking for a while. And this may, in the end, I think, actually, given this words about resonances that have been coming up, which, you know, in my head, for those who weren't privy to these discussions, this is some stuff that Tanya Hinderer described in her talk a couple days ago, where I almost think of it as the EMRI equivalent of a pulsar glitch. Essentially, due to the resonant effect of the cell force, you essentially move from one radiative track to another when these things happen. And so, you know, we may be in this regime where we have to do things kind of semi-coherently like this anyway. So someone who's actually done the data analysis on this, I don't know if Ilya or Alberto has numbers handy, but you may have comments on how well you can do with these when you do it sort of in chunks rather than fully coherently.
So I also wanted to sort of extend that question, I think. I don't understand why the paper on the event rates from EMRIs, from John Gehr and Cyril Finney and Tebbiat, Michele, they made some claim in there that computational cost was going to limit you to coherent searches that were no longer than a few weeks. And I don't understand why, if that's true, then you can't do coherent searches longer than a few weeks anyways. Then, okay, you might have some glitch or something, but how is that really different than your 3 weeks is up? You had to start with a new coherent segment or something. But I don't know if this really makes sense, because apparently the MLDC people are able to do, you know, the full length thing with the Bracken-Cutler waveform, so maybe I'm misunderstanding something.
And I think we probably should introduce a distinction between connecting searches versus doing source characterization once you've identified signals. It's like two different questions.
So, by way of a quick answer to Steve's question, that paper was initially written under the assumption that you were going to be doing matched filtering searches. So you basically wanted a short enough duration of data that you could create a template bank of a reasonable size rather than, you know, 10 to the 45 templates, which is clearly not feasible. And the duration of the data set determines how many templates you need, because the shorter the template bank, the greater errors you can have in your templates, so the less densely you need to pack them. But I'm sorry? Right. So there are still, in order to make things efficient, people still don't necessarily start out doing fully coherent searches. So now people do things that are Markov chain, Monte Carlo based, or similar stochastic techniques, where you sort of randomly, rather than creating a template bank in advance, you randomly explore the parameter space, and you basically place more templates in regions where you seem to be getting a good fit. People can still do things like, temperature annealing, or time annealing or frequency annealing, where you basically start out by fitting a short segment of the data first. You get a reasonably good fit, and then you kind of introduce more and more data gradually. But already once you have sort of focused in on approximately the right values of the parameters by looking at a short stretch of data. In the end, people are using essentially fully coherent searches to really focus in on the parameters as part of the multi-data challenges. So I think that indeed with these new techniques, that 2 week or 3 week rule of thumb is gone. And I don't think I actually have a good answer to Scott's question. So maybe Alberto does.
Okay. First one is very quick, because I don't have a crisp answer, with a number. That's one. The other one is for the computational costs for the MRE searches. So I think we actually don't know how long it's going to take. What is the real computational cost for a full-scale physical parameter search? I think the initial 10 to the 45 templates, and therefore no more than 2 weeks. Sort of estimate was very unwavering. Yeah? And people, I think the strategy that people have taken has been, let's concentrate on a smaller part of the parameter space. Let's now develop an algorithm that actually works there. Once we have the algorithm that works, then we see how long it takes, and then we multiply by a number in order to cover the entire parameter space. And we'll start worrying about computational costs. And I think, even the time scale for which Lisa is going to apply, maybe, I think, who knows what, we'll sort out the computational cost issue.
But can I come back? Actually, Alberto, while you still have the mic, I actually want to come back to the Mach-Lisa data challenge stuff. Does it make sense even to try at this point to have a challenge which tries to address the science question of estimating the masses and spins of the central black holes in those objects with some form of systematic built into it that's consistent with how bad we think we know things right now?
So personally, I think this would be a very attractive sub-challenge that we could really do. After, let's go through what we have ongoing right now, which is challenge 4. So we're talking about roughly 6 months, 9 months, whatever exactly time scale. But then we could really concentrate, let's forget about all possible other intricacies, and let's just take, Gaussian stationary noise, Lisa noise, and just throw in one or two emrys or a few emrys. That are constructed with waveforms that are more realistic, and see what current algorithms, based on what we know and the other tools that we are using, what they would be doing there on those sort of waveforms. And I think that would be also maybe is a sort of trivial exercise, but it would also serve the purpose of bringing together people that are driven, to try to solve this problem from a sort of intellectual push, and those that are actually working on data analysis and observations and so on.
Can I comment on this? I think it's not just a way to bring together the intellectual curiosity and the more practically oriented people who are driving the searches. there are systems for which this is a real problem. If you, you know, several people here, Duncan and Ilya, and I think you also, have been thinking about intermediate maceration spirals. And in that case, the systematics can be pretty big. For example, I don't think anybody's including the effect of the spin of the small body. And that could induce a dephasing, which is large enough that any extreme mass ratio template would probably lose the signal. So, you know, it's not just... I think there's some astrophysical motivation to try and do this.
I mean, the real problem here is that there is no, almost no money flowing into support this activity within LISA. There's people in their own free time. And I mean, we have to realize this. And so it's really, really hard you know, to sustain this effort. And we don't have a few people that are fully dedicated. So then I think it will start and doing some sort of project, and then it will fall apart.
Yeah, I think what I feel sometimes is that the sense of urgency that probably people had in the beginning when LISA was going to fly in 2008 is sort of lacking because because the launch date is being postponed at the rate of 1 year every year. Yeah. So
10 years away and always will be.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, neutron star binary, the collimator prototype analysis was done in 1998. Correct me, I think only now, 10, 12 years after, now the neutron star binary is, you know, fully routine in life. And this is probably the simplest search. With all respect for the past chair and the present chair.
Oh, yeah, so, take us both down at once.
It's a long time, even delay LISA, you know, till 2030.
Just a very brief comment that if this is addressing about two questions back, the question of how long coherent templates might be appropriate and what does this do to signal to noise ratios. My comment is the radiation, the time at which about a third of the people in the audience know this better than I do, the other two thirds may not know it at all, since it's directed to the latter. The time after which radiation reaction, self-force effects, introduce one error of phase error, one radian of phase error in an emery relative to a geodesic, is in the order of maybe a day or two. My quick pen and paper arithmetic is right. So if you want to do coherent searches with templates that are any longer than a day, you surely want Capra self-force type effects included in those templates. Right.
Okay, are there things that you had noted that we didn't talk about?
Yeah, we can't read.
I mean, I think the comparing the self-force NR and PN stuff was something, but that was touched on quite a lot in the meeting.
Right.
Looks like it has good potential.
Yes, and in fact, I think that's something that emerged this meeting that was, to me, pretty inspiring, the fact that, well, you can do a lot by comparing self-force calculations to post-Newtonian calculations, and that's something that really got started in earnest only 2 or 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. You can do a lot by comparing post-Newtonian theory with numerical relativity, and now you've got three ways of doing very exciting calculations that do overlap with each other, and you can hope to feed information back and forth and reinforce what you do by adding information you don't have direct access to. So I think that's something I think we'll hear an awful lot more about in the coming years, and I think that's pretty exciting.
It was sort of interesting. I remember in Alexander Latique's talk, the need to establish a common language when comparing a lot of these things was really clear as well. And I think it's very healthy if different communities are talking more. I particularly liked Alexander's, he had a table where he'd show, you know, different notations for masses and whatnot that had to be translated back and forth, things as simple as that. And I'm sure more such issues are going to continue to come up. Try to make commonality.
Right, and a related topic of discussion we had is, you know, are there observables that we could all agree are interesting and that we can calculate that would be something else than just waveforms? Because we all agree that waveforms are the ultimate thing we'd like to calculate, but there are all sorts of other things that can be extracted from all three types of calculations that could be compared with each other. And the purpose is, well, comparison is good for two things. It can be good to calibrate methods when you're a little bit unsure of yourself, but more importantly, I think it's about passing information back and forth across boundaries, which I think ultimately is going to be the more interesting, the more, you know, the more important reason to do these things. Anyway, so I think we've been going on for about an hour. Yeah, Duncan wants to say something.
So unfortunately, all I've heard is today's talk, so forgive me if I express ignorance, but it seems to me that a lot of the Salesforce community is obviously focused on Lisa, because that's where it's really important. But are people in the Salesforce community thinking about advanced LIGO and Virgo, which have good low-frequency sensitivity, and ET is kind of in the Lisa timescale, maybe before Lisa, who knows? But what are people thinking about, like Emmanuel said, IMRI, so 1 to 100, if, you know, that could be very interesting for advanced LIGO. It's not going to get the precision space-time mapping that you really want to get with Lisa, but maybe you can distinguish between a Kerr black hole and something that's not a Kerr black hole. If I ask people in the NR community to simulate a 100-to-1 system, they roll their eyes and say, you know, come back in 5 years. Yeah. And then similarly for hybrids, for advanced LIGO and advanced Virgo, where there's, you know, decent low frequency sensitivity, you may be talking about phase coherence over, you know, several hundred cycles rather than hundreds of thousands of cycles in Lisa. So is the Salesforce community kind of thinking about talking to, you know, advanced LIGO, Virgo data analysis people on the 5-year timescale, which is hopefully when we're going to see advanced LIGO data coming in?
I guess, can I fire back with another question? So what I think most people see those sources as promising sources for third-generation detectors. So I would like you to tell us that it's important that we start thinking about it now, because there is a decent chance that we're going to observe them with advanced LIGO.
And I think it's definitely worth thinking about. I mean, like Alberto said, you know, it takes us 10 years to commission these data analysis pipelines. I mean, I think there's a reasonable chance we could see, you know, something interesting in advanced LIGO with these, you know, 1 to 100 sources. Maybe not, it's speculative, but maybe we can start to kind of knock on the door of this, you know, answering the kind of questions that Lisa will ultimately answer with high precision. But, you know, I think advanced LIGO and Virgo give a good science motivation for looking at this stuff now. Maybe we'll get some cool astrophysics and science out of it, and it might, you know, trailblaze the Lisa problem a bit.
I think, actually, Duncan, before you hand back the mic, so I think, right, for a 100 and a 1.4 solar mass object, there's definitely cycles within the advanced LIGO.
Oh, yeah, there's a couple hundred cycles in the advanced LIGO. I mean, if we can get advanced LIGO down to, so the time scale for getting the low frequency sensitivity we need in advanced LIGO to see that is probably 2017, 2018, maybe, because when advanced LIGO comes on, it won't have the real, you know, bang, seismic wall at 10 hertz. So it's not, this isn't a 2014 problem, but it's not, you know, hopefully it's, you know, well before the end of this decade, and there are several hundred cycles of 1 to 100 mass ratio that could be visible with advanced LIGO, and even better with Virgo, even better with advanced Virgo.
I mean, and I think also one of the aspects, so going back to the science question point, right, again, the question becomes what's the interesting science things to do? And at the very crudest level, we don't really have black holes that we know of in that mass range. This would be direct evidence. And so if we could do something like that, that's really all you have to be able to do is measure the mass at all.
Yeah, right. So. Right.
Oh, yeah. So I was just going to say, too, that like Eric said, that producing a template, like the actual strain time series, is sort of the holy grail, but any information that can be provided about the waveform can be turned into an algorithm, and you know, you can search for those features in the data. So you know, you don't have to sort of throw up your hands and say, oh my gosh, I can't produce the time series in a 6-year time scale. But you know, if you can produce sort of things that might be features in the data that can be searched for, that even that's useful.
That's actually before John comments. Once that's one of the reasons why I was asking Leo Barak earlier, you know, where things stand on being able to take advantage of some of the results that were presented a couple days ago. Because even though they don't necessarily have waveform of the self force, they have corrections to the orbital phasing that are now coming out there due to this. And it seems plausible to me. That's one of the things we can do right away, is just take our simple models, relatively simple models right now for making the waveform with geodesic phasing, and just enhance the geodesics with those additional terms and see what kind of an impact it has.
Just wondering, for 1 to 100 with 100 cycles, to what extent do you really need the conservative part of self-force? Can you just get by with the waveforms you already have?
I'd like to ask you the same question, John. I see Ilya said in the back there. Yeah.
Before that, you go to 100. We did some initial studies where we said, well, maybe if we play with quadrupole movement, we can kind of measure a norm for the quadrupole, but we're just, you know, poking around the top, but like, we have no evidence.
So a couple of years ago, John Pierre and I did a very naive, tried a very naive way to answer this question. We basically said, okay, so how bad are the whole Newtonian waveforms? Well, let's take 3.5 k in order and 3 k in order and compare them for something like a 100 time mass to mass ratio, and look at how bad the overlap might get in for an advanced cycle in range of Newton star into a 100 time mass black hole. And maybe, you know, that's kind of an estimate of the error in both Newtonian waveforms. The answer is they get very bad. So then we said, okay, well, what about lowest order extreme mass ratio in spirals, or lowest order extreme mass ratio waveforms? Now, of course, we can't make the same comparison because we don't have second order expansion from M over M there with. But what we can do is take 3.5 pm waveforms, expand them to first order in the mass ratio, and extend them to second order in the mass ratio, and say the difference between those two is sort of the error, roughly speaking, in not having the higher order mass ratio correct. And we tried that, and the answer is the overlaps are very bad. Now, I should say that we did not do this carefully enough.
At what mass ratio?
100 to 1, so we're 1 to 100. Yeah.
So did you include
the LIGO image, the stuff that
was Ilya, did you include the leading, it was, I assume, restricted post-Newtonian?
Yes, so this was just
and what was the phasing at leading order in the mass ratio? Did you take it up to 3.5 or it's known as?
It was 3.5. So for the mass ratio comparison, we just took 3.5 pm and took only first order of the mass ratio portions of that versus up to second order of the mass ratio portions of that. Now, we did not maximize over all of the parameters properly. So what it means is that maybe for detection, these would still be good enough. But the answer is, because you would still have effective coverage of the space of waveforms, because we did not use maximization. But at least for parameter estimation, they are almost certainly not going to be good enough. And so the question actually that I wanted to ask related to, there's a discussion about how far we actually need to go in the mass ratio. Now probably for extreme mass ratios, people have said that maybe you don't even need to go to second order. But the question is, if we don't go to second order, is there a good way of telling how accurate the first order waveforms are? In other words, for example, there was a very nice study by Kurt Kuzma and Michele Balistieri that looked at systematic errors from massive black hole binary waveforms in LISA by comparing 3 pm versus 3.5 pm, assuming you're using one or the other for parameter estimation, and looking at what the systematic errors are. So that tells you that actually, you know, borderline, you are, even for high SNR waveforms, you're more or less limited by statistical noise, so it's probably both Newtonian waveforms are good enough. But the question is, could we do something like that for extreme matrix ring spirals? In other words, do we have a way to quantify the accuracy of extreme matrix ring spirals if we don't go to higher orders?
Well, I can think of ways of doing that that would not depend on doing the next order calculation and comparing directly. I mean, I think one purpose of doing comparisons, for example, between self-force, first order self-force calculations and, you know, Nico's favorite version of EOB would be to basically rely on the fact that EOB can be generalized to arbitrary mass ratios. So if you find good agreement for, you know, at first order, you can then ask how big are the second order effects if you believe that the framework will actually, you know, be a meaningful extension beyond first order. So, you know, you do it with Nico's favorite version and you reach a conclusion. You do it with, you know, somebody else's favorite version and you reach, hopefully, you know, a conclusion that's not vastly different. But, you know, there's so many variants of this game that chances are you'll find many different answers. But, you know, it's one way you can try to reach that. You
know. An experimenter would love that. They'd then just average over them and be done.
Right.
You'd have the systematics, right?
That's right. And that's not peculiar to us.
Yeah. And Ilya, one, you made a comment about not the waveforms not being good enough, perhaps not being good enough after you maximized over the other extrinsic parameters. You need to make a judgment call about what accuracy is okay for any other science you're going to do in order to make that statement. So beyond just saying you're not doing as well as you would knowing the perfect waveform within Gaussian noise, is there something else you're feeding in about the astrophysical use of those measurements?
So the only thing that we were looking at here was basically how much does your overlap or your ceiling noise ratio effectively decrease relative to the kind of fluctuations you might expect in ceiling noise ratio due to noise, right? So noise, you know, from noise we expect ceiling noise ratio to fluctuate by order of one, essentially. And if you if you're expecting to detect a source that has a ceiling noise ratio of 10, and you have a overlap decrease by a factor of two, that means that for parameter estimation, very crudely speaking, you're going to be dominated by systematic errors rather than statistical errors. So the question is, whether systematic errors are going to dominate your parameter estimation quality.
You're always dominated by calibration.
Yeah. And the point I was going to make was that the point I was going to make.
What we see, we may well be dominated by calibration errors, which we often forget to fold in, which is another form of systematic on our waveform.
But at the same time, if, you know, you have a measurement, you can't
be satisfied because you know everything perfectly, but, you know, the people at LIGO are not able to calibrate, to produce a calibration that is better than 10%, then this would provide a very strong incentive for them to do better. Now, if there are conceptual reasons why you can do better, then it's a different story.
Yeah, I wasn't actually suggesting conceptual reasons. I was asking, you know, so if I know that there are 1,000 solar mass black holes or 1,200 solar mass black holes, does it make much difference in my understanding of astrophysics of the universe? So my question is related to that.
So yeah. I have no idea.
So we did not actually, so no, I don't have an answer for precisely how much the actual mass would change.
Okay, so I think maybe it's time to bring the discussion to a close, and you know we can always pick it up again upstairs with the help of lubricants. So I guess the conclusion that seems to be unanimous here is that we've done some great work.